Okay, we have a little bit of a time constraint here. Several of us need to leave it well. So if we could possibly resume as quickly as possible.
Sure.
Okay, Chris, who's next?
Go. This is paper E, onerous contracts, and Tom Sobeland.
Yep. Thanks, Kristen. The next paper for the boards to discuss is memo 7E-161E, identifying onerous liabilities. The purpose of this paper is to address whether the board should retain the onerous test in the revenue proposals, and if so, how the test can be improved to reduce complexity and ensure that onerous losses are recognized only in circumstances when it would provide useful information for users. The staff wants to be sure that the onerous test only identifies contracts as onerous when they are truly economically burdensome to the entity. The paper is structured as follows. Paragraphs 6 through 8 provide a background of the proposals in the 2011 exposure draft. Feedback on the onerous test, which is in response to question 4, is summarized at a high level in paragraphs 9 through 14, but also included throughout the paper. Specifically, summarized user feedback is included in paragraphs 11 to 13. In response to question 4 of the exposure draft, some respondents questioned whether the revenue standard should include an onerous test, and furthermore, many respondents disagreed with various aspects of the test. To address that feedback, the paper first considers whether the revenue proposals should include the onerous test in paragraphs 15 through 18. If the onerous test were to be removed, the staff considered that losses on contracts with customers may be recognized by applying existing guidance such as IAS 37 and IFRS, or Topic 450 and existing industry-specific guidance in US GAAP. Furthermore, paragraph 18B of the paper explains that the FASB could also consider a separate project on provisions. In paragraph 18, however, the staff recommend that the onerous test be retained and improved in the revenue proposals to better achieve the objectives of convergence, to avoid creating complexity that arises when relying on existing requirements, and to provide useful information for users. The first question in the paper asks whether the boards agree with that recommendation. Paragraphs 19 through 62, then, provide the staff's evaluation of how to improve the test in the revenue proposals. While these improvements are asked as separate questions, the staff observed that many of the modifications are interrelated because changes to one aspect of the test directly relate to modifications made to other aspects of the test. And broadly, the staff recommend the changes together, because no one modification is adequate to address media concerns and to ensure that only contracts that are truly economically burdensome are identified as onerous. Those recommendations are, first, apply the onerous test to all performance obligations. This includes performance obligations both satisfied at a point in time and over time, and those performance obligations satisfied over a period of time less than 1 year. Second, change the unit of account to be the aggregate of the remaining performance obligations in the contract, which is how we define the contract level. The staff observed that by applying the test to the remaining performance obligations in the contract, losses will be recognized as the entity performs, but additionally, should the remaining performance obligations be loss-making, then an onerous loss will need to be recognized for that performance obligation in advance of performance. Third and lastly, the staff recommend a change to the costs considered in identifying and measuring onerous losses to be the lower of the following amounts. The costs that are incremental to satisfying the aggregate remaining performance obligations, and the amount the entity would have to pay to exit the contract if the entity was permitted to do so, other than by transferring the promised goods or services. And then finally, paragraphs 63 through 64 introduce a FASB-only section where the staff asks for clarification about not-for-profit exception provided in the FASB exposure draft. Specifically, the staff recommend the boards clarify their intention that an entity should assess the purpose and pricing of an individual contract to determine whether or not the contract was entered into for a social or charitable benefit, and thus can be excluded from the onerous test. So first, the staff asks that the boards first discuss and vote on question 1, which addresses retaining the onerous test in the revenue standard. And then depending on the decision reached in question 1, questions 2 through 4, which address the scope, unit of account, and measurement of the test, can be voted for independently, but again, the staff would like to recommend that the boards consider all of these recommendations together as a package. And then finally, question 5 regarding the FASB only not-for-profit exception should be discussed after reaching a decision on the prior questions.
Okay, great. Thank you, Tom. Ian, Would you like to start this one?
Okay, thanks, Leslie. Any comments? Pat?
Yeah, I think the staff has struck a reasonable balance here in terms of trying to be responsive to the concerns of, I guess, stakeholders and users. Obviously, you know, one of the big concerns here is not trying to identify and record owner's contracts where you don't really truly have an economically onerous situation. And so that, I think, we're dealing with appropriately in this context of designing a principle that says you're going to evaluate your remaining performance obligations as opposed to, you know, the entire contract, where you'd be taking into consideration profits that you've already booked in evaluating this whole situation. But on the other side of the spectrum, I do worry about situations where we may not be providing timely enough or early enough signals about the ultimate profitability of a contract. I understand that this project is about revenue recognition and not necessarily profit recognition, but the owner's contract test, I think, brings that issue into light. And so what I would like to suggest is something that Pat McConnell raised the other day in the Ed session, which is perhaps some disclosure principle where it's clear up front the reporting entity knows that there is a potential or a likelihood either for a significantly different pattern of profit recognition in the contract, so that there isn't a surprise. So if you have loss leaders built in to certain performance obligations, I think that should be communicated in the nature and the context of the types of, you know, revenue contracts that you enter into.
We might come back to this. We're looking at question one.
No, I understand that, but in general, I'm saying that I agree with bringing this into the revenue recognition project, and I think the way to handle it is the way you've gone, that the path that you've taken I support, but as I said, I think it just needs to be enhanced a little bit with some disclosure.
Okay, Paul.
My inclination is to leave the requirement in IAS 37. I understand the argument on convergence, and that may be persuasive as we go down on this project, but I think we've got a pretty good set of requirements in IAS 37. Impairment under 37 reflects the net of the cost to fulfill and the benefits you'll get. In other words, the revenue coming in and the cost to fulfill would be the cost of meeting the performance obligation. In the tee-up, I heard a suggestion that our existing requirement may not be adequate. But I'm not sure what the inadequacies are. Nor in the paper. Could you explain why IAS 37 is inadequate to deal with the onerous revenue contracts?
I think that comment was raised in the context of U.S. GAAP, possibly, because I think we'll end, if we rely on existing guidance for IFRS, it's 37, but for U.S. GAAP, that answer might be topic 450 plus some industry-specific guidance. And it may not quite capture all of the onerous losses adequately for contracts with customers. So I think that's the comment. And we raised a little bit, I think, in paragraphs 16, 17, 18 around that in the paper as well. And that's why we suggested that possibly the FASB might think about doing a separate project on provisions if that was the path that was gone down.
But if we were to go down the IAS 37 path, does the staff believe that 37 would do the job for onerous revenue contracts, setting aside the convergence issue?
Well, it'd be easy to make sure 37 applies to contracts with customers. I think we still might be asked for additional guidance because I think there's some concepts in 37 that could be described better, such as the economic benefits notion, and also the the lower of costs in 37 have been subject to interpretation, and that's how they've been applied. But I think people might request some additional guidance there as well, and that's something sort of we mentioned as well as a potential dot in terms of that decision.
And I think they mentioned too, Paul, that if they did additional guidance, one of the unintended consequences is we spread that guidance beyond revenue recognition, you know, so that maybe one of the problems is burdened up 37. Yeah. Pat.
Oh, I was going to say pretty much what the staff just said. I think I prefer to, if possible, to leave the onerous test in the revenue model. I think IS 37 is okay in most circumstances, but it would certainly need to be tweaked if we were going to rely on it for this new model. And I think if nothing else, you'd have to bring in some of the concepts that are in IS 11 on contract accounting in to 37. And as Ian just said, it would open up 37, and that's not cool. Where we want to go right now, I don't think.
Big tech.
Yes. My inclination is we should include onerous contract test in the revenue standards. However, my only concern is the overlap between the IS2 and the onerous test. Your proposal is you are going to expand it, not only just over time, but also 1 year and point in time. I think there are some views that the one-year test makes complexity, and to some extent, I agree with it. So therefore, we should remove the one-year test. That's what I can agree. But in the case of point in time, I think there are lots of overlap between the IS2, and perhaps unit of account may be different. In that case, that gives huge complexity to the preparers. So one thing, if we remove the point in time test, only the problem is the case that is shown in the paragraph 21, which is about the price risk of raw material. And that area cannot be covered by the IS2, which is understandable. So is there any way for us to cover only that part without asking onerous test on the point in time?
Well, is it in paragraph 21 of the paper? Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, yes. So, which was pointed out by the Hong Kong. This is necessary, I understand. But in order to cover only for this, do we do the overlap of IS2 and onerous contractors?
And we will, I think another comment that was made either in, I think maybe in one of the Ed sessions, is that we need to make it clear that asset impairments, including IAS2,
yeah,
they would be considered before any onerous loss is recognized in revenue. I think you raise an interesting point because there is that paragraph in IAS2 that I think would still apply to these contracts that entities would need to consider. But I think a lot of people thought that even not just the 12-month exception was added complexity. I think that limiting the scope of the onerous test to just over time, I think, also added complexity because people weren't quite sure what to do about point-in-time contracts. And they were worried that there just wasn't enough in existing guidance to get transparent information on those type of contracts. So I think there was a lot of feedback on that. I think what we're saying is that IS2 impairment would still apply to those tests, but you would think about that before you consider the onerous contract test in revenue as well, and we'd make that clearer in the drafting.
Well, I support the staff recommendation, but my support is conditional on knowing how the onerous contract test works.
Yeah.
I can support something I don't know exactly how it would work.
But in principle.
In principle, I do. And but again, if question four, our response is not in line with the staff recommendation, I then would prefer to keep IS 47.
I think the examples which we discussed in the educationalization also demonstrates, okay, depends, the outcome depends on whether which kind of cost you include, incremental, variable cost, or all cost. And then on the benefit side, if you look at the performance obligation level, the contract level, or even higher. And that demonstrates to me, based on really the individual cases, facts, and circumstances, that you can't find one rule. You cannot say, okay, it is incremental or it is on a contract level, because different situation, I think, give you a different economic outcome on what is right and wrong. And therefore, I think, okay, we should more go into the guidance with IAS 37, because that is more open and you requires more judgment what in the specific situation I think the right outcome is. And therefore, I would really think, okay, that IAS 37 should be the guidance and we should not have more detailed here in this standard.
Okay.
I think what Philippe and Martin said, I echo that for me to answer the question one, I need to see how the rest of the answers figure out, because there are, like I said in the education session, we are creating a new set of issues which may or may not look very sensible in my mind. So I think in the light of that, this is a revenue project, not a cost project. And to some extent, onerous obligations arise because of the cost aspects of it. I reserve my vote on the one because I want to see how the rest of the things develop.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, I generally propose suggestions to leave in 37. And for two reasons I already expressed during the education session. First one is, you know, I don't feel any major concerns in the past or on a contract test. And I checked with Daryl. Daryl worked in IFRIC for many years, and whether during his term, if he got a lot of questions, and he said, "Oh, got some, but never
nothing substantive."
Nothing substantive, and also even they discuss, never get any, you know, thing. They won't add new requirement or change the requirement. And secondly, you know, we always have problems. You know, something in common, whether we should spread over in different standards or in a particular standards. And if we want to decide to put on a contract of related to this standard into revenue standards, then in the future we have to think about, you know, how about the leasing or other revenue type of transactions, whether we want to also have similar, you know, investigation again in a particular standards. Just like impairment tests, you know, we normally would say that, you know, if financial instrument related go to financial instrument standards, it non-financial instrument standard go to 36. It's straightforward. Not necessary for you to rethink about something which you feel bothersome, but actually not bothersome.
Okay, any other? Taki,
sorry about that.
Listen, would you be happy if we took a vote that those yes, those no, and those that want to wait and see? And then we'll revisit.
I'm thinking that the discussion that might take place here is a little bit different. Maybe we should have our board express some questions and views first and then vote. Does that seem okay?
Yeah, okay.
Larry?
I guess, first of all, I thought the paper was great, et cetera. However, as Mark expressed before, I don't agree with that recommendation.
pretty neat.
And If you take a look at why we addressed onerous contracts in the first place, the revenue proposal, I think it goes back to a desire to maintain in the revenue standard some guidance that previously existed in SOP 81-1 on percentage of completion contract accounting. Otherwise, U.S. GAAP doesn't have a heck of a lot on when to record an owner's contract. We also put into the exposure draft this one-year threshold in order, I believe, in order to simplify the application of the standard. Unfortunately, our constituents didn't agree that that was simplifying it and therefore asked us to expand it. When I take a look at the staff's proposals in totality, I think we are introducing tremendous complexity into the standard, and I'm fearful that we really don't know what the outcome will be. I am fearful that different contracts or different ways of entering into contracts might lead to very different results in your financial reporting when, from a practical standpoint, those differences in business practices might not be very significant. I'm very fearful as to what happens with point-in-sale or point-in-time traditional revenue contracts where you have loss leaders and how those get recognized. I guess, to try to cut to the chase, I'm supportive of, if we really need to retain something that exists in the literature related to 81-1, let's retain that for the time being. And I would suggest that we spin off an owner's contract type of a test or project to make sure that we really have the opportunity to spend the time necessary to explore the complexities that exist. I'm not sitting here saying that I would rely on FAS 5. I wouldn't do that. I'm not saying that I would rely on IAS 37, although it might have some concepts that we might want to look at. But yet, at the end of the day, I think we're introducing in this proposal some significant complexity, and it's going to have an impact, a major impact, I believe, on financial reporting, and I'm not convinced that we've done enough work to really understand what the implications are.
Tom?
I agree with the staff recommendation, so I guess I'm disagreeing with Larry's evaluation. In part because I don't think we will get to that project he's talking about on a timely basis, and we will have scope issues about that project as to whether it should be applying more beyond revenue. I think it will open up the whole series of onerous contract accounting and impairment testing, and that is a very long exercise. I am also supportive of the staff recommendations because I think what's going to happen out of this particular project or this particular decision is a decision as to when we ought to be recognizing losses before the transfer of the goods or services. And what I like about the decisions, especially because it relates to incremental costs only, if I'm an outsider, I would like to know that when I'm out there, I'm not even getting revenue to cover my incremental costs. That's a pretty big deal. And I'm not so sure that the loss leader contracts would actually be loss leaders in those circumstances, because the incremental cost of razor blades may not all be that high, as an example. So I do think that there's an important foreshadowing of when you're in a very difficult circumstance that is gained by the staff's recommendations on totality.
Larry, what do you think the complexity being added is?
Well, in the education session, I gave several examples of transactions that were fairly similar where you might get very different answers. If you want me to go through them, I can.
Sorry, that's how I remember that. Okay. Just looking at the staff recommendation, it doesn't seem very complex to me, but I forgot about the range of transactions.
Define incremental costs for me. That is pretty complex. So if you have a direct labor force that are subject to union contracts, do you take that into consideration? Or if you have direct labor costs that are not subject to union costs, do you get different outcomes depending upon whether unionized or not unionized? I mean, I think it's pretty complex.
Russ?
I think GAAP needs an onerous test. I think we have one. I think IFRS has one. They're not aligned, and I think they can be improved. But I generally agree with Larry. Once we get into incremental cost, and I compare incremental cost to what is it done in practice for what is inventoriable, and I think about the impairment model for inventoriable cost versus incremental, it's not going to be aligned, and there's going to be issues there. So I think the most efficient way is to carve this out. And rely on existing GAAP. In other words, not make an amendment to onerous testing, and start working on ways to improve the model related to onerous contracts, as well as considering there's other improvements we can make to other cost things. So, but for today, I would carve it out.
Does convergence bother you in that recommendation? Because it's not likely we'd be necessarily doing that together.
I'd want to talk about that.
Yeah, in terms of complexity, if we do what you guys were suggesting, how difficult is it going to be to essentially pull out of GAAP all of the revenue guidance that we have, but yet leave this one area? Is there not a risk of it being sort of a messy separation?
In my mind, yeah, it's going to be messy at first, but I think we can scope it such that people know that if they were subject to it before, they could be subject to it going forward.
Remind me what besides 811 has specific guidance in it.
I think there's I'm going to have to look to be totally sure with you, but I think it's predominantly 811, and then I think there's some pieces in software and perhaps media and entertainment.
So one idea would be to leave the 811 guidance in place for long-term.
And let me just clarify, because for software, I think it's a narrow piece of software. It's not broad.
But is it the software that you're applying 811 to? Because an aspect of software, if you have X, Y, and Z, I can't remember what that is, you apply 811 to those contracts.
So
and the media and entertainment is to some degree being evaluated by the EITF.
Yeah, okay. I'll have come back to you to be totally clear.
So one idea would be, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Elsa.
Sorry, I was just going to say that it is not its own software onerous contract revenue recognition. It does rely on something else. I'm not sure it refers back to 811. I actually think it refers back to 450, but we can sort of confirm that.
So the idea for a carve out, so I hate that word, but sorry, a
spin off.
Thank you. That sounds much more positive. of this area would be to essentially leave the very sparse guidance that we have in place in U.S. GAAP in this area intact for now. The rest of it we seem to have lived without for decades. And maybe there isn't as pressing a need. The consequence of it, of course, is that the cost side of this will remain even less converged than it would have otherwise. I mean, there's other elements to the cost that we're not dealing with. So that would be, I think, the most significant consequence.
But on that note, the predominant amount of the time, the costs are not going to be converged. Because the onerous tests are not, hope they're not recurring events
that's
at a company. Yeah.
You guys, I guess, I'm just saying, you guys are willing to leave that in place for some sort of indefinite time because we don't know when that might come back, right?
Yes.
I'm going to ask Tom and Daryl, I guess, on this point. How long would be an acceptable time period to deal with this issue? If we said, let's bring this back as a separate issue, how long would be acceptable and what would be unacceptable to the timing? Because the revenue recognition is not going to be in place for some time period.
Well, there's two issues for me. This is our opportunity to converge. An owner's contract test on revenue. And I don't think we're going to have an opportunity other than now. And second of all, if we open this up as a separate project, I don't think we're going to limit it to revenue contracts. And then I think we could be at this for beyond my term.
Why do you think we would not limit it to revenue?
Because I think the issues will come up and ask what the interaction it is with Statement 450 in a broader sense.
And to Leslie's point earlier, we've lived with this for decades. What's the precedent to address it?
What's the theoretical idea that we only do owner's contract tests for revenue for certain contracts? Why does that make sense?
In certain industries.
In certain industries.
Right now, it's industry-specific, generally. And it's
so your concern is that we're wiping out industry guidance and
we're wiping out industry guidance everywhere else to spin off a project where we keep industry-specific guidance for this particular aspect of it. I agree with Tom that this is going to be a very slippery slope, and he's going to bring up Topic 450 stuff, and we've had trouble even doing disclosures in Topic 450, much less recognition measurement. So I don't really have an appetite for a separate project. What I would recommend is keeping it in this standard. I do worry about the last thing that Larry said, which is any unintended consequences. And so if we were to do it in this, you know, here in July, we've got 6 months that we could do some additional outreach on what we decide today to figure out whether it's workable and what might be the unintended consequences that I would like to do.
Mark, and that was directionally where I was thinking. So we have some time here. How can we best use our time? Is it to put a question in and ask folks?
We're going to final,
but is that something we do, a question to outreach?
Depending on what our decisions are and the degree to which we think we've changed things, we'll have to ask ourselves whether we think at least that aspect needs to be re-exposed.
Okay. Anybody here have additional points? Okay. Ian, I'm going to hand back to you.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody want to comment on that discussion?
FS members' discussion about costing side. And owner's contract related cost is a part of it. And we already decided long time ago we should not deal with because it's totally outside scope. Mm-hmm. I think their discussions further affirm my position not tackled.
I'd just like to ask the staff, if we were to revert to IAS 37, it seems to me that the underlying question in this paper was unit of account, contract or performance obligation. If we revert to IAS 37, is that question answered and what is the answer?
It is unit of
account. 37, the unit of account is the contract.
Yeah. And that's not as good an answer, in my opinion.
Okay.
You know, I just want to say one thing. If you move from performance obligation, unit of account to contract, for the most part, the answers that you get in this are similar to you get in 37. The reason is that it is there is an interpretation in 37, which is para 66, which says that it's a remaining performance obligation. Okay, the moment you move from PO to contract level, the game is over in this thing. If you want to retain the performance obligation level in the ED, yeah, there is a different answer. I completely agree with Larry, and I'll give you a small example to agree about the unintended consequences and the problems we get in the industry when we are practicing it. Incremental cost for an aircraft. For example, I'm 80 kilos weight. and I'm the only one who bought the plane ticket. What is the incremental cost? There's no incremental cost because airline will say, you know, up to certain weight, we will not put any more additional fuel into the plane because the plane is anyway fueled up. I don't need to do it. So the moment 150th fellow buys it, the weight is going to tip to something else because we have too many heavy people. So it's going to tip to something else. Then you got to buy it. Then it's an incremental cost. It gets to the whole discussion about variable and semi-variable becomes really hair-splitting arguments. And I really think we are introducing, and I said this yesterday in the education session, that the incremental cost creates complexity and diversity in practice. If you want to, and I'll give you another issue with the sequencing. All I'm trying to say is I'm saying the moment you move from the PO to contract level, there is not much of a difference of the answers that you get in this to the thing. You can talk about the economic benefits and all those things, but I am saying that for the most part you won't get it. And I echo what Vegu said, that in practice we have not heard anything much on this issue. Unless net income between the FASB and IASB is the same, onerous contracts is not going to change anything in the future.
Can I just clarify that if you move to the contract level, the inputs and the outputs into the test, as we sort of defined it in the 2011 exposure draft, are still different from 37? Because in the 2011 exposure draft, we limit the sort of inflows to the transaction price. 37 considers a wider notion of economic benefits, and
the moment cost, you put incremental, you get to the same answer.
Well, the costs in our exposure draft are the direct costs, whereas 37 is interpreted under an incremental notion. So there is a difference. I don't know if you'll get the same answer in all cases because there are certain contracts that will be not assessed as onerous under 37, but would be assessed as onerous under our test because it's a narrower test.
Okay. I don't get it.
On the convergence point, of course, the US could just adopt IS 37.
Nice.
Bring it all about.
Since that's so popular in your area of the world, that was a good idea.
Okay, Leslie, I don't think I've heard anyone else wanting to speak. How do you want to take this forward?
Yeah. I guess we'll go first. Okay, I think I hear a couple of different alternatives. One is the staff recommendations, which is to include guidance in the RevRec standard along the lines that are in paragraph 4 of the memo. Another idea for us would be to not include specific guidance in the RevRec standard, and then a separate decision about whether to embark on a new project to address this issue. Well, that's what I was going to say. And then a third would be to do and carry over the limited guidance that we do have at this point in time.
Well, I think the second and third are the same. The way I was thinking about it is either go with the staff recommendation or you say scope onerous out of this, retain existing gap, and then we evaluate whether and if so, how to proceed to improve it. That's what I thought the two.
Okay. And then for good measure, I am going to throw on the table the idea that we would adopt something like IAS 37 to address this issue here, noting that several ISB board members raised some interpretive issues about that. But just for good measure so that we could have all of, I think those are all of the alternatives on the table. Okay, so who would support the staff recommendation as articulated in paragraph 4 of the memo? That's 3. Who would support an approach to basically rely on our existing guidance in US GAAP and then separately evaluate a project potentially to address this in a broader way? That's 4. Okay, over to you, Ian. Tom. Bigger part.
Okay. Paul, do you want to come?
I just have a question about the second alternative. If we rely on existing gap, I assume that proposal could include a pointer in the revenue standard to the existing gap. Say, don't forget, deal with onerous contracts, and it even could include implementation guidance a bit of some sort. Do you agree with that? At least a pointer.
I think, Paul, we'll kind of look at the various alternatives that maybe we could have, and whether that is we group that guidance into a certain place, because I think right now the difficulty is the 81.1 stuff is in revenue. Maybe that's not the right place for it to be. So I think in our codification we can work through some of the specifics.
This topic 450 apply.
Okay, I'm readable.
Okay, so I think we'll just go to the question one. Who agree that the onerous test should be included in the standard?
Subject to question four, yes.
Included.
Three.
And who do not agree that it should be included?
Both of us be relying on our existing guidance for the time being. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I'm characterize it. There is no onerous test, a specific onerous test in the final revenue standard, and existing guidance of the two boards would remain.
Would both boards agree not to amend existing onerous models as part of the revenue regulation project?
So for the IS 37 plot, does topic 450 apply generally to all contracts?
Doesn't amend the current practice.
I don't think that applies to the statements.
I didn't ask whether people were paying attention to it. I'm asking, what's the scope of 450?
Patricia would like to ask you this.
Sure. Yesterday at the Ed session, we discussed the possibility of some additional disclosures when there were performance obligations that might result in, not might, would result in a loss, even though the overall contract was profitable. If we could we still consider whether such a disclosure was possible, even if we're relying on 37, since we're recognizing revenue on performance obligations, but we're evaluating onerous at the contract level? Could we still consider whether such a disclosure is possible?
I think it's even more critical.
Well, I think, you know, there was some disclosures in the revenue package related to onerous, so I think we'll have to sort of think about that. I think we'll have to think about that when we bring disclosures.
I mean, from our point of view, remember that there are disclosures under IS 37.
Yes, I'm just asking that you take a look at those and think about our concerns about...
I think it gets more difficult because, you know, what we just said is now that we continue to use IS 37, IS 37 scope will be broadened to also include IS 11, and I think amending the disclosures.
I do understand Pat's and Pat's concerns, but should it be limited to onerous contracts? Say you have a contract, onerous performance obligations. You sign a contract which has two performance obligations in it. One has a 50% margin, the other one a 0% margin. It's not onerous. In first period, you will have 50% perform and 50% margin. The second period has no margin. We wish to be alerted to the fact that this margin is not spread over.
I don't disagree with that, but I don't want to be greedy either.
Yeah. I think the issue is a broader issue than just performance obligations which are onerous. It's performance obligations which have quite a different margin from the average in the contract.
Okay, we'll get back to the disclosures that staff will bring up. I think we're through there.
So, other questions to not apply?
We have one more FASB only topic. Who's going to see that?
So the last question was, does the FASB agree with the staff recommendation that the original intent for not-for-profit entities? contracts with the social and charitable benefit is a contract-based assessment and therefore agrees with the interpretation proposed. So I guess the kind of question is there going to be an onerous test for these contracts?
No, I would describe it as a clarification that just because everything you do has a mission orientation, that doesn't get you out of this.
Right.
You have to look at it on a contract-by-contract basis.
Get out of what? We've decided not to let
So are we applying the onerous test to these contracts as well?
Is there any current nonprofit guidance?
I think the question is, do we want to add anything for not-for-profits? And I think the answer is no.
Okay.
Okay.
Fair enough. So, good. Kristen, anything else for today?
Nope, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.